This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. Coming up, demonstrators take to the streets in Thailand calling for curbs on the power of the king. And
brilliant run by Maradona. Fantastic goal. Unbelievable.
Tributes flying for soccer great Diego Maradona, who's died. After more than 2 years in an Iranian prison, Australian academic Kylie Moore-Gilbert's been freed and is on her way home. The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, has told Channel 7 he spoke with her earlier this morning.
We're very happy. She's obviously very thrilled, but she's processing it all, as you'd expect. She's on her way back to Australia, and she's with Australian officials who are giving her all the support she needs. There'll be quite an adjustment for Kylie. She's gone through a terrible ordeal, an absolutely awful ordeal. The injustice of her detention and her conviction, Australia has always rejected, and I'm just so pleased that Kylie's coming home.
The Melbourne University lecturer was jailed on espionage charges, allegations she's always denied. Barbara Miller reports.
Just last night, the Free Kylie Moore-Gilbert account tweeted 804 days and counting. How many more days will she be forced to endure? This morning, the account run by friends and colleagues of Dr. Moore-Gilbert was active again. If this proves true, 2020 has made the mother of all comebacks, it said. This being a video released by Iranian television, which shows Ms. Moore-Gilbert in a grey headscarf and wearing a mask, appearing to be waiting at Tehran Airport. She's accompanied by two women and then taken to a minibus and driven off. Three men draped in Iranian flags are then shown being welcomed with chants and flowers. It's been more than 2 years since Dr. Moore-Gilbert was arrested in Tehran after attending a conference. In a statement, the Minister for Foreign Affairs, Maurice Payne, has confirmed she's been released and will soon be reunited with her family. The statement says the release was achieved through diplomatic engagement with the Iranian government. It offers no details on the reported prisoner exchange. Washington Post journalist Jason Rezaian was jailed in 2014 in Iran in similar circumstances to Kylie Moore-Gilbert and held for more than 500 days.
I'm extremely happy, overjoyed for Dr. Moore-Gilbert and her family, but I, having gone through a very similar experience at the hands of the exact same people, I know that there's a long road of recovery ahead of her.
From your experience, do you think she would be being informed about what was happening? I mean, she did look quite bewildered, didn't she?
She's been in isolation for a very long period of time, even longer than I was. And I can tell you that after a year and a half of being held in the same facilities that she was, I had very little understanding of what was being done on my behalf in the outside world. And all I did have was access to Iranian state media, which portrayed me as a villain. In exactly the same way that they have portrayed her. So you're not exactly sure what to believe, and I've been rather critical of the Australian government for what I believed was neglect in this case. And I hope that that we find out that they've been working long and tirelessly for her release since her capture. But it's shocking to me that it's taken this long.
Iranian reports describe the three released prisoners as businessmen jailed for breaching U.S. sanctions. But there are reports in international media that at least two of them were jailed over terrorism offences in Thailand. Hadi Gaimi, executive director of the Center for Human Rights in Iran, spoke to RN Breakfast.
We do know that 7-8 years ago, there was a group of Iranian agents bent on carrying a terrorist activity in Thailand, and two of them got detained. A third one fled to Malaysia, and we never heard what happened to her. But the reason we believe that two of the people are those Iranian intelligence agencies, because one of them, as he was fleeing Thai police 7 years ago, the explosions in his possession blew up, and he lost two legs. And the footage shown of people who return to Iran today does show a person being pushed on a wheelchair.
No details have been released about Kylie Moore Gilbert's return to Australia. In her statement, the Foreign Minister, Maurice Payne, said Dr. Moore Gilbert and her family have asked for privacy at this time.
Barbara Miller reporting. Iranian state media is reporting that Dr. Moore Gilbert's been released as part of a prisoner swap. The Prime Minister has refused to comment on those details. In the meantime, the Foreign Affairs Department's released a statement from Dr. Moore Gilbert. The academics thanked everyone who supported her and campaigned for her freedom. She says it's meant the world to her through what she calls a long and traumatic ordeal. Young people in Thailand have sent a signal to the authorities that they won't be deterred from continuing to demand curbs on the power and wealth of the Thai king. Despite 15 leaders of the student protest movement being charged just yesterday with insulting the monarchy during recent demonstrations, thousands of people turned out last night in the latest rally in downtown Bangkok. Southeast Asia correspondent Mazoe Ford reports.
At times, the demonstration looked more like a festival than a protest, but simply by being there, 8,000 young Thais were taking a stand. Just hours earlier, they'd learned that 15 leaders of the student protest movement, who'd loudly called for monarchy reform, were being charged under Thailand's strict lese majeste law with insulting the royal family. If found guilty, they could face up to 15 years in jail. It's the first time in 2 years that police have enforced this law, but if it was meant to deter young people from coming out to protest, it had the opposite effect.
Yes, I am scared, but if you say this country is democracy, then we should be able to speak about everything. It is a basic right of people.
It's not okay. If this country has real democracy, we should be able to express our thoughts.
Rallies that began in July against military-backed Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha have increasingly demanded curbs on the power and wealth of King Maha Vajiralongkorn, breaking a long-standing taboo on criticising Thailand's monarchy. Dr. David Streckfus is an independent academic in Thailand. He says that far from being afraid of being charged with the royal insult laws, the young protest leaders actually wanted to be.
They said, go ahead, charge us. The more you charge us with this law, the more exposed the weaknesses of this institution will become. And some of these people have been charged with 20, 30 charges so far. So they, in a way, they almost have nothing to lose.
He says as the protests have grown in size, the leaders have grown in confidence.
They're betting that something has changed in Thailand. And or if it's not changed, it's become apparent because once it's been talked about, it's impossible to put it back.
Poincha Chawang Pongpan is an outspoken Thai academic and activist living in exile in Japan.
Right now, the return of Lese Majeste also signifies a desperate attempt on the part of the Thai government, of the Thai palace, to try to curb the ongoing protests.
The government's other strategies to try to de-escalate the situation haven't worked. Activists don't believe that laying Lese Majeste charges will work either.
You know, the law would not stop them. If anything, it would even motivate people to come out to protest.
The Thai government says it's been open-minded to the protesters' rights and freedoms, despite many imprudent expressions which offend the majority. Yellow shirt royalists continue to gather in large numbers too, to declare their disgust at the protesters' demands and their unwavering support for the monarchy.
Southeast Asia correspondent Mazoe Ford. The US has recorded its sharpest weekly rise in COVID deaths since August and yesterday notched up its deadliest day in more than 6 months. New infections are now averaging more than 170,000 cases a day, with the number of people in hospital receiving treatment breaking records every day. But even as the country's top health agencies warning against gathering for the Thanksgiving holiday, tens of millions of Americans have already taken to the skies and highways, as North America correspondent Catherine Diss reports from Virginia.
Jim Strang knows the cost of COVID-19. His mother, Shirley, lost her battle with the disease.
We were a little bit optimistic. You know, she came back from the hospital with no fever. We were thinking, holy smokes, you know, she might make it through this. And then eventually when it settled in her lungs, that's where we knew that it wasn't good.
She died in hospice care 2 days after being discharged from hospital. He managed to say goodbye through her nursing room window.
We left there thinking that it was a goodbye. And then Sunday, the following morning, we got a call from the facility saying that she had passed.
The virus has claimed more than 250,000 American lives. More than 80,000 are in hospital receiving treatment. A pandemic high. But it's not stopped tens of millions travelling for the Thanksgiving holiday against the advice of health officials. More than 3 million have passed through airports. 45 million more are expected to travel by car to family gatherings. Alexa Aragonés has a message for those pushing ahead with family gatherings.
One by one, we started getting a text message saying, I'm positive, I'm positive, I'm positive. And with every positive that rolled through, a little bit of my heart tore. It's just devastating to think that my family, the ones that I'm closest to, could, you know, potentially at the worst die.
15 members of her family got coronavirus after gathering earlier this month. Her mother spent a week in hospital.
COVID-19, you know, of course, gave her pneumonia and it spread to both lungs in all four quadrants.
But the coronavirus pandemic isn't only a health crisis. It's still got a stranglehold on the American economy. Tens of millions remain without work. 54 million people, including 18 million children, are going hungry. Ahead of Thanksgiving, food banks have been overwhelmed. At one we visited in Virginia, more than half of the people getting free food had never been there before. Ramatu Sisi among them.
Now I lost my job. It's not easy. I have my kids. No money for food. So my social worker sent me here this morning to come get food for Thanksgiving.
The economic crash, like the health crisis, is far from over. If infections spike over the Thanksgiving holiday, as health authorities fear, America could be entering one of its darkest winters in living memory. This is Catherine Diss in Virginia, reporting for AM.
And thanks for your company on AM. We're at 16 past 8. It's almost a month since Victoria recorded a single case of coronavirus, and in response to the COVID-free streak, interstate border closures are coming down. New South Wales is officially open to every state and territory from this week. Tasmania will welcome Victorians back from tomorrow, and Queensland's promising to lift its restrictions on December the 1st. But Western Australia is yet to commit to a date to allow Victorians to cross its borders without a mandatory two-week quarantine, and in the process, it's ignoring its own current guidelines. Bridget Fitzgerald reports from Perth.
Businesses like Neil McLeod's rely on interstate tourists.
We need it very, very badly, and we need those people to come and spend their money in our state. We're competing against every state.
The Margaret River tour operator says it's time to reopen the WA border to states without community transmission.
We don't want to see any coronavirus in our neck of the woods, but we're in a competitive market in Western Australia. 80 to 85% of our population lives on Eastern Australia. And we need them planning their holidays to come to the west.
Western Australia eased its hard border rules earlier this month. Visitors from jurisdictions considered very low coronavirus risk are allowed to enter the state without having to self-isolate for 2 weeks. WA regards very low risk as places that haven't had any community transmission for 28 days. Currently, Tasmania, Queensland, the ACT and Northern Territory fit that definition. But with Victoria on track to hit that WA target tomorrow, Premier Mark McGowan is refusing to be drawn on whether Victorians might be allowed to freely enter the state.
We'll be cautious and we'll be careful and we won't take risks.
WA's maintained the strictest border protocols in the country in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. For some businesses, that hasn't been a bad thing. Jeff Waldeck manages a restaurant in Albany on the state's south coast, which has benefited from a surge of tourists from within the state.
We're certainly happy with how it is. Albany's just one of those beautiful towns that people head to, certainly people in the city. So we've got a lot of people from around WA that are heading down to visit us that possibly normally wouldn't.
However, the state's tourism sector is heavily reliant on tourists from other parts of the country, and 34% of interstate visitors into WA come from Victoria. Chris Rodwell, the chief executive of Western Australia's Chamber of Commerce and Industry, says if the government sets a benchmark, it needs to stick to it.
It's absolutely critical that we understand the WA government's approach to the border. And at the moment, what was a clear approach has been muddied. And unless these decisions on borders are made on the basis of them being clear and transparent, then businesses are going to have little certainty.
While the state waits for the WA Premier to make his move, tour operator Neil McLeod has a message for him.
We'd like Mr McGowan to reconsider, and when there's no coronavirus from these states, we need those people to be able to fly in and come down here.
Margaret River, tour operator Neil McLeod, Bridget Fitzgerald reporting there from Perth. We've heard a lot about how the COVID pandemic's affected the disability community with infections in group homes and many left without support. The Disability Royal Commission conducted public hearings earlier this year specifically on those impacts, and it's expected to hand down its findings today. Advocates are hoping for wide-ranging recommendations, including national guidelines to better support people with disability in case there's a third COVID wave. Disability Affairs reporter Naz Campanella has more.
Severely autistic man Jared McKenzie enjoys swimming and lives with his mum Karen in Melbourne. The 21-year-old receives assistance from a support worker, but in early September that carer became unwell with what he thought was a sinus infection. The next day, Karen McKenzie says she also started to feel sick.
I woke up with a bit of a sore throat, but then I started to feel achy and overnight really cold, had to put several layers of clothing on, thermals to wear to bed.
She then got a text message from Jared's support worker letting her know that he'd tested positive to COVID-19. Karen and Jared also got tested and they too had been infected.
Yeah, it was a bit scary, really. My initial thought was, oh, what's going to happen now? Like, how sick are we going to get?
Karen and Jared McKenzie were left days without support and information before finally receiving support from a community organisation called On-Call Group Australia, which provided carers. The organisation's General Manager of Operations is Laura Green.
We had a dedicated group of support workers who were able to meet the extraordinary requirements of perhaps isolating between shifts, being able to isolate for the 2 weeks after they'd assisted someone with COVID-19, and had the qualifications and experience enough to be able to walk in to any new location and provide support to people that they had never met before.
In August, the Disability Royal Commission examined the impact of coronavirus on the disability community, hearing stories of people feeling isolated, overlooked, scared and anxious about disruptions to their care and services. The Commission will today hand its report to the Governor-General and it's expected to make multiple recommendations. Laura Green hopes they include creating national minimum standards for support providers to follow.
It's just unacceptable that people with disability go without support, without having a shower, without being able to do what they do every day, because providers don't have enough support workers or they've failed to plan in advance of what's needed.
And for Karen McKenzie, she's just glad support was there when she and Jared needed it most.
Yeah, it's really important to get that support. As I said, I don't know what I would have done after too many more days of no support. When you're not feeling well yourself and you have to look after someone else, it makes it that much harder.
Melbourne mother Karen McKenzie ending that report from Disability Affairs reporter Naz Campanella. The trolls took to Twitter, but in the UK there's been praise for Meghan Markle for her emotional account of suffering a miscarriage earlier this year. In a New York Times article, the Duchess of Sussex revealed she lost a baby in July and she writes of an almost unbearable grief. Support groups say with one in four pregnancies ending in miscarriage, Meghan's words will help thousands of women. Here's Europe correspondent Samantha Hawley.
2.5 years ago, after marrying Prince Harry, Meghan Markle made it clear she wanted to use her new platform as a royal to be a voice for all women. Now women's groups have applauded the Duchess of Sussex for a powerful piece she's penned for the New York Times. In it, Meghan Markle describes feeling a sharp pain while she was holding on to her son Archie, saying she knew as she was clutching her firstborn child, she was losing her second. In the deeply personal account, the 39-year-old noted despite the commonality of the pain, the topic is riddled with shame and a cycle of solitary mourning. Alice Whedon from the Miscarriage Association UK says Megan's words will help to break down the taboo.
I know that when people who are, you know, high-profile people talk about it, it creates a lot of noise. You know, there's a lot of people then discussing it. People that we talk to, they find it helpful. You know, they feel less alone.
Meghan Markle is not the first royal to have a miscarriage. The Queen's granddaughter, Zara Tyndall, suffered two. And Prince Harry's aunt, Sophie, the Countess of Wessex, suffered one in 2001. But it's the first time a royal has given such a raw and public account. Emily Nash is the royal editor at Hello.
I think Meghan's decision to speak out about this will really resonate with people all over the world. You know, there are so many families who've experienced this. And having someone with her profile recognise the pain and the suffering will mean a lot to people, I think.
It's not the first time the Duchess has worn her heart on her sleeve. In an interview with ITV last year, she was asked if she was doing okay.
Thank you for asking, because not many people have asked if I'm okay. But it's a very real thing to be going through behind the scenes.
And the answer is, would it be fair to say not really okay, as in it's really been a struggle?
Yes.
Katie Nicholl is Vanity Fair's royal correspondent.
I think it's incredibly brave of her to do this. She's clearly done this deliberately timed at a time when I think people are going through a lot of hardship.
Buckingham Palace says it won't be commenting on a deeply personal issue. This is Samantha Hawley in London reporting for AM.
The football world's in mourning following the death of one of the greatest players of all time, Diego Maradona. The Argentinian star led his country to World Cup glory. He died at his home in Buenos Aires after suffering a heart attack. He was 60. But the superstar's life wasn't without its troubles. He'd suffered from poor health in recent years, including drug and alcohol addiction. Caroline Winter reports.
He was a football genius with his feet.
And Maradona gives Argentina the lead.
But many will remember Maradona for his hand.
The England players protesting to the referee.
That first goal against England in the 1986 World Cup in Mexico, when Maradona famously captained Argentina to victory, became the infamous Hand of God goal that for many defined him. Former England player Peter Reid was playing in that match.
The crowd in the stadium exploded in terms of they'd given it. I mean, I was just outside the 18-yard box and seen it. It was cute the way he did it, but it was on the pitch, it was obvious.
Maradona recounted the moment to the BBC in 2006.
I ought to thank the guy upstairs, the beard, as I call him. He gives me opportunities and I make the most of them. And I give my all to make the most of them.
Maradona's was a rags-to-riches tale, rising to stardom from humble beginnings in a Buenos Aires slum, the fifth of eight children. On his way up, he moved to Naples in 1984 and twice helped underdogs Napoli to the Italian title. News of his death is hitting hard there, where fans lit flares and candles and chanted, "There is only one Maradona." After the 86 World Cup triumph, he coached Argentina's team to a second successive World Cup final in Rome in 1990. But by 1991, drugs and alcohol began taking over his life. He was hospitalised and reportedly near death in 2000 and again in 2004 for heart problems blamed on cocaine. At just 60, Diego Maradona died of a heart attack at his home near Buenos Aires. His fans in mourning.
Diego is the greatest thing there is, the best. For me, Diego is everything.
As a player, he gave us everything. I believe that there is no Argentine who says that he didn't give us anything.
Tributes are flowing on Twitter. Here in Australia, former Socceroo Craig Foster has described him as one of the most gifted players in the history of the game.
Diego Maradona was one of the most revered, loved, criticised, hated, controversial, a sports people, but more than that, an extraordinarily gifted footballer who carried his country to the highest glory of the World Cup in 1986, and he was loved by so many.
What do you think it is about Maradona that captured the world's attention?
He spoke to the people. He spoke to the poor. He spoke to those underprivileged. He spoke to those disrespected. He spoke to those wanting to fight against the system. He was very much the people's hero.
Argentina has declared 3 days of mourning.
Caroline Winter reporting there. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Angela Voipierre.
And I'm Stephen Smiley, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. Joe Biden will inherit a public health crisis beyond any US president's experience when he takes office on January 20th. At the moment, there are up to 180,000 new COVID-19 infections every day in the country, and the US holiday season, starting with Thanksgiving, is about to pour fuel on the fire.
Today on The Signal, in the dying days of the Trump presidency, how bad could the pandemic get? And what can Joe Biden realistically do to turn it around? Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.